Yeah, let's call to order the Senate Labor and Commerce Committee meeting, March 17th. For the record, Senator Bennett, Senator Ray, Senator Zaroff are here. Senator Eliason will be joining us here shortly. And due to an illness, Senator Sackett will not be with us. We have been covering the issue of insurance, and we have narrowed our topic here to two bills, Senate Bill 404 and Senate Bill 377. Senate Bill 404, which was previously heard, there was a recommendation by Senator Ray that we have a title change, and there was a new committee substitute drawn up at that recommendation with the title change. At this time, I would ask Senator Ray to take a look at that title, and if he agrees with him, then I would ask for a motion to accept the committee substitute.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. As far as I know, one of the people here from the department, they agree with it?
Yes.
Is there? It's all right with you?
Narrowed the scope of the, right. The title.
That was the only thing that I was nervous about, Mr. Chairman, was to, it was such a broad title before that we could liably get anything back, and we think this is more conducive to good legislative draftsmanship. So I don't find anything wrong with the title that's agreeable with the agency, and the rest of it I think we've gone through pretty well, and unless there's something somebody has to say.
Okay, could we move for the adoption then of the...
I would move for the adoption of the committee substitute for Senate Bill number 404, in lieu of the original.
Okay, is there... you ask unanimous consent?
I do.
Is there objection? Okay, we have a committee substitute for Senate Bill 404, then it's adopted before us. And at that time, we had concluded testimony on the legislation. And with the new title change, there's an indication from the department that there would be no problems with that. It still meets the scope of the bill. Briefly, we'll open up public testimony. Is there any testimony on Senate Bill 404, committee substitute? Okay, hearing none, we'll close the public hearing. And I would ask the members to look at the letter of intent for a possible adoption with the passage of this bill should it leave the committee. And the letter of intent reads basically, it is intended the Senate Labor and Commerce Committee that the Division of Insurance urge both domestic and foreign insurance companies conducting business in the state to write insurance policy contracts in comprehensible layman's language. To get away from a lot of the legal jargon.
I'd love for the adoption of the letter of intent.
Is there objection? Okay, hearing none, the letter of intent is adopted. What are the wishes of the committee regarding the committee substitute for Senate Bill 404?
Move 404 out of committee, individual recommendation.
Okay, unanimous consent? Is there objection? Okay, Senate Bill 404 then is moved from the Labor and Commerce Committee. The next committee referral is the Finance Committee. We also then have before us committee substitute for Senate Bill 377, Labor and Commerce. We have also had hearings on this piece of legislation, and this is basically the five provisions that we're looking at with tort reform. The basic changes that were suggested at our last meeting have been incorporated in the bill on page 2. Under the periodic payments, it was suggested that we put an annual interest rate increase, and the suggested increase on this here was 5%. That's certainly subject to any discussions you may have. And as we proceeded on through, the next major change was, you'll notice that it is quite a bit of difference between this and the bill that we had previously. The other bill had a three-year repealer clause. This seemed to create some confusion. And as a result, what we have done is we have taken away the repealer clause, and we just simply have, in effect there, the main components of the bill will be going into effect. An amendment to Civil Rule 82, mandated structured settlements, periodic payments, modification to joint and several liability, modification to prejudgment interest, and placing a $250,000 cap on non-economic awards. And these sections will not be repealed within 3 years, but rather section 15 on page 8 of the bill states there that the legislative intent, that the intent would be then that the legislature requests that the governor direct the Division of Insurance to monitor the effect of the act on the premiums being charged for liability insurance. Basically, the changes that we've gone in through here, we're asking the governor to direct the Division of Insurance to report back to the legislature any positive or negative changes, and at that time, either deal with the with this bill here or parts of it. Does that meet?
Yeah,
Senator Wright.
I just have a technical question here, and it's something that popped out on page 2. At the end of line 5, going into line 6, it says, "A court shall, at the request of a party." Are we talking about the insured party or the insurer? Do we make a differentiation? If we're going to have it the injured party, we should state the injured party. If not, if it's going to be either party, either the insured or the insurer, then we should say either party. But one or the other, we should make it definite what we're talking about.
Okay, we do have the drafter of the legislation here. Mr. Ford, maybe you can address that.
Mr. Chairman, my name is Mike Ford. I'm an attorney with the Division of Legal Services. I think the point the senator is raising, the way it's drafted presently, is that either a plaintiff or a defendant could request that the judgment be paid periodically. I believe that was the intent.
I don't know if we want that. Do we want the insurance company to be able to say, well, we're going to pay this guy a lump sum, they're going to pay this other guy the regular sum? Either one or the other should say. I think the injured party should be the one that makes a request where they want the periodic payments.
That would typically be the case.
It's possibly a call. I don't know. It might be a policy question, but I would move that we add the word after A on line 5. Add the word A injured party or an injured party. So the injured party is the one that gets hurt is the one that can say whether they want a periodic payment. I think that's the one that makes the determination.
Okay, Senator Ray, what I would suggest there is that if you would hold that motion until we get into the closed portion
of this week.
We are still open for public hearing. I think if you'd remain, we still have a few questions. We may have some further questions.
Fine.
Okay. Any other questions here regarding the contents of the bill? Okay. We did have another individual requesting to testify on behalf of the legislation. At this time, I'll open the meeting to...
While he's there.
Okay, Senator Ray.
Perhaps you could, once more, just take us through section 040, 0917, 040, page 3, starting at 9-11. See if I really understand what you're saying here.
Okay.
You just tell me what it says.
Yes, that'd be fine.
040 simply creates by statute what is the present state of the law by case law. And what we require here is that if someone contributes to their own injury, in other words, there's an automobile accident, and let's say driver A hits driver B, but driver B contributed to the accident perhaps by not driving the proper speed limit or whatever, but say they contributed to the accident in some manner. The fact that the driver B contributed to the injury means that he is not prevented from recovering as occurred in the past under the state of law. At one time, it was a defense to a lawsuit that the person contributed to the accident. What this section simply says is that if you contributed to the accident, that doesn't prevent you from recovering damages. It simply diminishes your recovery.
Senator,
you're both going down as hypothetical. Both going down the freeway at 70 miles an hour, side by side. you're exceeding, both of you exceeding speed limit, one person loses control and swerves and hits the other one. That's what you mean, right?
Correct.
So that doesn't bar the one that's got hit, even though he was exceeding the speed limit, and he didn't do anything other than perhaps he was exceeding the speed limit, he still has a chance to recover for the injury that was caused him by the fellow that swerved into him.
Correct.
Right. Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Are there any further questions? Okay, before we continue with the public testimony, it might be proper for us to adopt the committee substitute.
I'm going to ask unanimous consent to adopt the committee substitute.
Any objection? Okay, we have the new committee substitute then before us. And Tom McGinney, is that correct?
Yes.
I have you listed here wishing to address the bill. Is that?
Yes, I do.
Can you come forward, please? For the record, if you would identify yourself, please.
I'd like to introduce myself. My name is Al Timani, Sr. I'm the chairman of the board of the Citizens Coalition for Tort Reform. And we have reviewed your bill, SB 370. Heaven, we think it embraces many of the concepts that the Citizens Coalition of Tort Reform has presented as their desires to have put into legislation this year. All there are some modifications that we would most respectfully suggest he reviewed. I'd like to go through those briefly. And following that, I'd like to add on some, possibly some other suggestions and some ideas, introduce perhaps some evidence that you need to have a look at if it can be of any assistance to you. The modifications to SB 377 Evan, is that on the cap of non-economic awards, we would like to see added on to that after $250,000 per incident. That is more definitive because it specifically states the maximum amount allowed per incident. This has happened in other states, and it's been an area that has had to go back and been litigated over and over to define $250,000 for what we feel like specifically per incident would be clear and precise. On the aspect of periodic payments, I'd like to review that. It is the positions of the Citizens Coalition for Tort Reform that a person, that the injured party, have the choice of either taking the periodic payments or the lump of money. We feel they should have that choice. We think that the eliminate the mandatory 5% is something that needs to be addressed because many times, and I want to go back and reiterate that as I do a lot of analyses of structured settlements. We prepare structured settlements, and I'm fortunately located in the state and probably the only expert in the state on that, is that we would say that by putting the mandatory 5% on there, you are closing the capacity to do what they call deferred compensation payments on down the line in lumps of money. It's a very expensive thing to add into policy, and deferred lumps could be more appropriately utilized with those sums of money. So we would say that we want to have those structured settlements as flexible as possible for the injured party to say, this is how I want my monies to be paid to me. By mandating a 5% escalator in there, puts a lot of restraints on the type of capacities you have and the financial programs that you can design. So I would say that might be an area you'd like to have a look at.
On that particular section there, what would happen if it said that periodic payments could be increased at the rate of no less than 5%?
Well, I think you're still having a problem there because you don't have the flexibility to use those funds to do some other type of construction in a structured settlement besides a monthly income. Normally, we use maybe a 2 or 3% cost of living escalator in there in some cases. In some cases, we don't. We take those monies and defer them to future large lumps of money. So there's no two settlements are the same. There's no standard format for a structure. It all depends on the needs of the injured party, and those needs are not quite always the same for everyone. And so we design and do different types of designs based on the needs of the injured parties. By having a 5% in there, or in essence any type of escalator in there, it really confines the area that the injured party has to choose as to how he wants to receive his money. And that's, I don't think we would, you know, that's entirely up to you, but our thoughts would be we want to see as much flexibility granted to the injured parties to receive their monies under the best possible conditions. I think also we have to be very, very careful in that structured settlement aspect, is that when that settlement is prepared, the agreement is signed, that there can be no judicial change of the way those monies are paid. Once they're implemented and once it's operational, there cannot be a change, because if there is a change at any time on the way those funds are paid, then that triggers a taxable situation under Section 104A2 of the Internal Revenue Code, and that is very, very crucial to the Periodic Payment Act. So we want to make sure that there is no capacity for anybody to make a change on the size of the payments, the method of the payments, the length of the payments, the times of the payments. I think I would be more than happy if the committee would like to work along with Mike Ford to massage that and make that perhaps more comfortable. The arbitration provision we think is great. We would like to know perhaps that a person have the right to represent himself in an arbitration, or having somebody represent him besides an attorney, and that there be perhaps a separate fee schedule. I'm not sure what the intent of the committee was on that. The offers of judgment. We think that the interest on an offer of judgment should commence from the date that a lawsuit is filed or an arbitration notice is filed, if that's the case. At that point, both parties are on notice that they have to comply and that they have to try and get that lawsuit settled. It might be very well a consideration to have interest rate scheduled at the rate of T-bills. That's only an optional thought. There are some things that we would, of course, always like to see added on to form the comprehensive solution that's necessary to solve the crisis in the state, and that's the collateral income sources. And the most important thing is to, in those aspects, is to protect the plaintiff from any recovery by any defendant after there's been an offset granted. We would like to see and continue to see a sliding scale of attorney fees. It's good public policy, and it achieves the purpose of getting a larger percentage of the money of the injured party. That's the whole concept. Wrongful death is an area that is very, very debatable, and we certainly can respect the committee's position on that. Punitive damages is an area I'd like to spend a few moments on. It was the intent of the Citizens Coalition for Tort Reform to have punitive damages revert back to the state. We have all heard about victims' rights, and we certainly want to keep those in mind. But there's a class of victims out there of which the state has established a fund for. It's called the Victims' Compensation Fund. And that fund was intended to partially repatriate people that were injured in a criminal action through no fault of their own. We understand that fund is always slightly anemic, and it is the intent of the Citizens Coalition that punitive damages revert back to the state, and that possibly a mechanism could be established where those punitive damages could take care of those type of victims out there. The Victims' Compensation Fund, which is already established, it's funded, I think, about $100,000 a year, and it's never enough. We would be taking care of a grossly overlooked segment of our society by, I think, addressing that issue. The statute of limitations is an area that somewhere on down the line, perhaps not this year or perhaps this year, that needs to be addressed. frivolous lawsuits, there is an area that we think has to be addressed. Hopefully this legislative session can do that. Is that it's good public policy to have a control of frivolous lawsuits, is that if any person or attorneys that are going to file a case with the courts, then they should verify that is a good, solid case in their belief. We ask other people to get second opinions. We ask accountants to get second opinions. We think that might be an area that has to be addressed, but that's entirely up to the committee. I'd like to talk on Rule 82. We think that is a very important consumer issue. And I brought along some evidence to introduce here today. And I'll give this to the committee on Rule 82. Is currently, Rule 82 was, and I understand, a rule set down by the Alaska Supreme Court as an experiment and possibly as a rule to take care of public policy needs to pay attorney fees. In reviewing that rule, there's been 33 appeals on that rule to the Alaska Supreme Courts, and not one of those appeals have constituted the original intent of the law to take care of a public case. Additionally, there is a surcharge built in by the insurance companies to every homeowner's policy in this state of Alaska and virtually every automobile policy holder in the state, anywhere from $3 to $45. Now that is built in to their policy charge in addition to what the normal risk charge on that would be. That's because of Rule 82. Now, we have assumed that there are 300,000 homeowners in the state, and there are probably 300,000 people in this state that have an automobile policy that they own. You own, I own, everybody owns. We'll say the average cost of those, because of Rule 82, is $10. So you take 300,000 homeowners and 300,000 automobile policyholders, that's 600,000 times 10 bucks a year is $6 million that is possibly, we feel very strongly, is being pulled out of the economy and simply to provide the necessary risk protection for Rule 82. We think that's a very strong issue that, however it can be done, should be addressed. It is unnecessary. Alaska is the only state in the union that has it and does not achieve the public policy for which it was intended. I'd also like to move over and explain to you that the Citizens Coalition for Tort Reform had proposed in our initial presentations to the legislature that there be some regulation of the insurance companies. Unfortunately, we have not had that introduced in any bill. And we would like to strongly go on record and perhaps ask this committee if it would be possible yet to get a bill out for some regulation of insurance companies. Those provisions we would like to see is if there in any aspect where there is a policy cancellation, a rate increase, a policy alteration of any type or nature, that the insured parties be given at least a mandatory 60-day notice before that can go into effect. We think that's good public policy. Keeps all parties equal and gives that person at least a chance to recover and try and find insurance elsewhere, or at least has a period of time to reasonably react. We think there should be full disclosure from insurance companies on a quarterly basis. Now, what we mean by full disclosure is most of your insurance companies are stock companies, so they have a quarterly report anyway. We would like to see the reporting to the insurance commissioner's office for the reserves, premium rates, loss ratio, investment income, claims paid, claims incurred, asset versus liability ratio, gross profit, net profit. Mutual companies also have that capacity. And I'll tell you why we think this is so important to have done. Is because currently we understand that the insurance companies report annually to the insurance commissioner's office. And we don't believe that is quite significant enough to monitor a company that might be getting into trouble. If you look at something four times a year, you have a higher chance to detect a problem before it occurs than after its occurrence. You can monitor that company on a quarterly basis. You know if they're getting into trouble. You know if they have the ratios. You know if they have the capacities. You also will know if perhaps their rates are too high. I think that would be good public policy, and we, the Citizens Coalition Return Fund, would like to see that implemented in some type of bill this year. I think in closing, I'd like to leave you some information I have here for the committee, and I'd be more than happy this time to answer any questions that you may have. I want to thank you for the opportunity to come down and make this presentation today.
We want to thank you for your testimony. You might want to take a look at the committee substitute for Senate Bill 404. I think we may have addressed some of your concerns in regards to regulation of some of the insurance companies, particularly on the cancellation notice. You may have addressed that, so you may want to take a look at that. And if it doesn't fully do it, you can offer your comments to the Finance Committee on that particular bill.
Okay.
This bill here does not have a broad enough title to encompass all of that. And I appreciate your concerns in requesting us to look at other pieces of legislation. We do have numbers of other pieces of insurance legislation in the committee that, if time permits, we will consider dealing with. But it's been very difficult, and the number of national conferences that I've attended, the underlying feeling is that what do we do with the insurance problem? Nobody knows a direct solution. There are many different ideas and whatnot, and I think what we're doing here is looking in the committee, we're looking at different options there that we have, and it's kind of a hit and miss. We try something now, and if it works, well, let's look at something else, and it's just going to be something we're going to gradually have to get into. So I appreciate your comments. Are there any questions there of the witness? Committee members?
Okay, well, thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
I'll leave this information here with your committee.
Okay, thank you. Is there anyone else here wishing to testify on committee substitute for Senate Bill 377? If not, we'll go ahead and close the public hearing. There were some suggested changes. Are there any suggestions by any of the committee members? On page one, under non-economic damages, it was suggested there that we, on line 18, insert per incident. Any comments or concerns on that one?
Oh, per incident. You better be a little more definitive than that, because what we're talking about, I think the drafter could probably come up with a little better language than per incident.
Four.
Mr. Chairman, this issue has come up before, and the way the system presently operates, someone who is seeking damages is encouraged to join all their claims in one action. So typically there is not a problem in determining or in the limitation of the damages, particularly on a particular incident. The question may arise if there is an injury and then at a much later time there is another injury. But I don't think we're talking about per incident there. We're talking about incidents which are separated either by time or the nature of the injury.
Pursuit.
If you wished to make sure that you were limiting it to those injuries caused at a particular time, then I could give you some language that would do that, to make that clear. But I would not suggest that you use the word per incident.
I don't. Pursuit. That's the end of it. I mean,
Well, we said that, Senator. We say in an action, that action would take care of. That's what a suit is. It's an action to recover damages.
Where does it say in? Okay.
On line 12.
Line 12. In an action to recover damages.
Correct.
Goes on to B.
Well, Mr. Ford, with all due respect to the vagaries of the legal profession, we're supposed to write these laws for John Public. And not to let you people understand it, and then we have to get a lawyer to make us understand it. So that's what I'm suggesting. Mm-hmm. Although it does say, and it might be repetitive, it wouldn't hurt anything. But I understand what Mr. gentleman. I can't remember how to pronounce your last name.
Al.
Manny.
Al. That's Al. I can see what you're saying, but I'm not so sure that that's it's that clear either. And I've been here 22 years, and it isn't that clear to me. Okay.
Again, if you wanted to have some language to accomplish the separation of time issue, I could do that.
That wouldn't hurt that, I think. Okay. No, I don't think so. What would you suggest?
Well, I would suggest, I don't have the language in front of me, but doing that, specifying that the recovery, the amount of damages awarded, could not exceed $250,000, and then specify that unless there was a later injury separated in time, that limitation would not apply. Right. I understand what he means by principle. Like I said, the incident has the question has come up before, and I do have some language. I just don't have it with me that would solve that problem.
Okay. You want to move then for a conceptual amendment to that?
If you would, yeah. I would move a conceptual amendment to clarify that these are occurrences, not incidents.
There are actually two occasions. It's there's the time problem and there's one other problem too.
Right. I'm not trying to second guess my hand. I would move that asking that as consent.
Any objection? All right, let's see if we could have that language in before us here shortly. Okay. Senator Ray, on page 2,
right.
You had indicated on line between line 5 and 6.
And any other areas that should be, so we identify the injured party as the one that makes the determination whether periodic payments and not the insurance carrier or not the other party. It's the injured party himself makes the determination.
I don't have any problems with that.
I'd ask you to ask consent on that. You can do that.
Certainly.
And any place that misses it, I might miss it farther back too.
Any objection? Okay, there was a question there on lines 11 and 12 on the 5% and the problems that could cause. Mr. Ford, do you have any comments on that?
I think that the testimony really referred to the question of if you're going to award a periodic payment, do you want to allow for interest? And the point being that a periodic payment allows, of course, the injured party to take the funds at a particular time, invest them, spend them, or make whatever decision he chooses. At least as I interpreted the testimony, it was that that may diminish the value of doing a periodic payment type of settlement in the eyes of the person who is providing that periodic payment. That's the only problem that I can see. It makes it less attractive to an insurance company, for example, because they are not only giving a periodic payment, but now they're giving interest on that payment. And the payment itself could, of course, be used by the injured party for investment or whatever purpose, or another purpose.
Senator Lassen.
Chairman, what's the mechanics of creating these periodic payments? Would the judge consult with the injured party and say, These are the options we could offer, and then with that the procedure, the judge say this is the way it's going to be.
Well, assuming now, as I understand what you wish to do, the only time that you would be required to make a periodic payment is if the injured party said yes, I would like it periodically. In which case, the judge would determine. You'd have a lump sum of damages. He would determine what amount would be paid to you periodically. And the dollar amount of those payments. And you could, for example, purchase an annuity, or you could make some other type of arrangement to provide a stream of money over a period of time. And also they would determine how much time, the interval between payments. Is that what you're referring to, the actual mechanics?
I'm referring to, does a judge determine that arbitrarily? Or does he ask the victim, which schedule would you prefer?
Well,
or if you don't get the periodic payment, would you accept the lump payment after seeing what we put together for you?
The court would work with the injured party. because it's the injured party requesting the periodic payment. And obviously, if it didn't satisfy the injured party, they wouldn't ask for it, and they wouldn't be required to take it under the language.
They'd ask for it, but they wouldn't be required to take
it. No. They could take it as a lump sum if they chose.
Right, and when the game plan was laid before the injured party, they'd have that choice whether to take it as a lump sum with an interest rate or not, or mm-hmm. take it on these repayment schedules.
Correct.
So it's sort of a wide-open issue.
It leaves it completely up to the injured party.
Right.
But the way that it's written in here, though, it doesn't leave it wide open. It leaves it strictly to 5%.
Well, the interest rate is fixed.
The interest rate.
Yes. I think Senator Lassen is referring to the choice between taking it as a periodic payment or taking it as a lump sum.
Well, in the bill here, that the interest rate would be fixed.
The interest rate is fixed, correct.
Okay. Without this in here, then it leaves that interest rate open to negotiation, or how would that...
Well, as present law operates, a periodic payment judgment requires money be paid at certain periods. And unless the payment is late for some reason, let's say you got an annual payment on July 1st of every year, the only time that you would receive interest on that payment is if it were late, if it were paid in September or October. Then you would receive interest on your judgment. But the judgment would not be due to you under a periodic payment scheme until that particular date. Now, does that answer your question, Senator?
I think in part it does. Senator Lassen?
Well, I don't think it doesn't refer to lateness of payment, does it? It doesn't refer just to an automatic cost of living increase.
I'm not talking about the existing language in the bill. Yeah. Yes, the language in the bill requires a fixed interest rate that applies when judgment is entered. So it would be X amount of dollars plus 5%.
Right. And I guess the feeling was there that if you had a judgment awarded and you went for periodic payments, $100,000 over 10 years, $10,000 a year, that's all you would receive. But with the 5% escalator clause, you would receive 5% on top of whatever was left. The other interest rate there for a late payment would be something that would be handled totally separately.
That's correct.
If for some reason that their payment was late, then there would be an additional interest rate on top of that.
Correct.
Mr. Chairman, that brings me back to the original line of question, was that the judge, if we were silent on the 5%, the judge could say, these are your choices, periodic payment, maybe with an escalator clause in it, or 5% or whatever. So the one-time payment with the settlement or else any series of things they can work out on themselves. So the burden would be on the victim to say, okay, this appears to be a plan which better fit my situation, and whether there was interest in it or not, it would be totally up to the victim to choose to make that choice. What we're doing here, we're putting another element into it. We're saying, besides these other options, you're going to get 5% a year if we leave it the way it is, which sort of removes some of the ability to arbitrate it out on a fair basis to the victim.
Well, I don't know that it removes the options. It simply requires that interest be paid also.
Okay.
Chairman, but it does sort of weigh the options in favor of one side, rather than let him look at the whole picture and just make that decision himself.
It gives him some incentive to choose periodic payment. That's true. Yes.
Okay. Any... individual wishes on this? I'm going to leave it in.
I think they ought to get something. Okay. 5% seems
right. The problem, I think, even if we do not put it in, it's certainly the discretion of the judge to do that himself.
This is a... I remember.
Well,
Mr. Chairman, you shouldn't misunderstand me. A judge would not award interest. He doesn't have the power to do that. The jury or the court, if it's the trier of fact, will determine what the damages are. And damages are X amount of dollars. The judge would not say, Mr. Defendant, you have been judged guilty of such and such an injury and you owe X amount of dollars. And I'm going to give the plaintiff 5% interest. He would not do that without statutory authority to do that. And that's what this does. It requires the judge to give interest. Now, we have a statutory interest rate which says if you are late in making your payment, then we're going to give interest on that judgment. That is a completely separate item, though. Another thing I might add is with the change in this language, presently a plaintiff could ask for periodic payment under present law. He could ask for that and receive it, assuming that the defendant had no objection to that. And it's not uncommon to have that happen.
Okay. Any further comments on this one?
On that section?
On the section one, leave it as it is pretty much right now.
I just assume put the 5% in there.
5% is there.
It is? I didn't see it anymore.
On lines 11 and 12, page 2. Periodic payments to be increased at a rate of 5%.
Where did the 5%, Mr. Chairman? Where did the 5% come from to start with?
The
recommendation
5%
by some
was,
group or what?
No, just an arbitrary figure that I had picked up there. The insurance companies were telling us that they had an escalator there at 3% that they wouldn't object to, and if you go with the average percentage there on what your savings account would, if you took the lump sum and put it into your savings account, the interest rate that you received would probably be in the neighborhood of 5-6%. That's why I mentioned earlier there that 5% was purely an arbitrary figure that we put together here for discussion purposes.
I'm still a little confused. I would like maybe the witness that testified prior to this to maybe explain a little more clearly at a later maybe time. Can we just leave that and go on to something else?
Sure. Okay. Are there any other?
Well, the next section, I believe it is 040. I asked a question on that. I'm not too familiar at all with this. Legal history, is this in effect at this particular time at the day? Is this the way they do it? Is if you get hurt, even though you are 75% wrong, you can charge somebody else with 25% of negligence or some contributory negligence because you were 75%. You were drunk and got out of the car and walked across the road when you weren't supposed to, but another guy come by and was speeding and hit you with an automobile.
Well, typically how it operates, Senator, is that it diminishes recovery. If you were 75% at fault and you were to sue someone trying to recover your 25%, they would certainly counterclaim against you. And that 75% fault that you had would simply be offset, or their 25% would be offset. And you would wind up paying a considerable sum of money, probably.
Well, what I mean is if Fred has a personal injury suit against me, And I in turn turn around and say he was a certain percentage responsible because of his machinery that he sold me, then I can claim the 25% against him, right?
If he contributed to the problem.
Is he going to come back and sue me? And how is he going to sue me? For what?
Well, that...
I mean, is this the way they do it now?
Correct. Correct. This doesn't prevent you from suing. It just diminishes your recovery.
Because it seems to me that that's another area where we need a little reform. That's a big area where somebody's always trying to point to somebody else as their fault.
Okay. Any comments on the remainder of the bill?
On page 5, section 2, this is mandatory arbitration, right?
Correct.
For $100,000 or less. Or less than $100,000.
Okay. On page 6. Lose property or something? What I'm trying to get at is how would you have a personal injury and you acted in bad faith? I don't know what how would you do a bad faith? How would you be in a state of bad faith and commit a personal injury to another?
In a property action?
Well, what anything. I mean, what I'm getting at is, where does the words in bad faith fit?
Well, I'll see if I can think of an example for you, Senator. I guess I can think of certainly bad faith in contract actions.
Right.
And that could certainly result in damage to property.
That's covered in this, then, right?
Correct.
Okay. Now, with personal disregard of the rights of another in causing injury, man, that's like open sesame. Do we have anything in the definition section that covers that at all? That covers that?
Not presently, Senator.
Maybe is there the possibility that we could put a section in the definition section, more or less coming down a little bit on it, Mike, so that we know for this statute, a reckless disregard for another means such and thus, so that we can more or less pinpoint rather than leave that wide open area. That's really wide.
We could provide a definition.
Would that be agreeable to you, Mr. Chairman?
That would be
something that would help us a little bit.
I think I wouldn't have any problems with it. What would you suspect would be included in that, in the contents of this bill?
Well, I believe that, first of all, let me say, I think the terms are fairly well defined in case law. They come up quite often, and I don't have any ready phrases for you, but I don't think it would be too difficult to pin it down. Reckless disregard, I think, simply implies where you act with that disregard beyond what you would normally expect. It's a reckless disregard as opposed to simply being ignorant or making a mistake. You made a mistake that was a reckless mistake.
Do you think you can come up with a definition there that we could use?
I think I could find some language for you, Senator.
Is that satisfying?
I think it's going to satisfy the people who is going to deal with the statute.
Okay.
Not any personal wishes one way or the other.
Okay. Anything else then on this regarding the remainder of the bill? Any questions on the on section 15, the legislative intent?
Well, if you're asking for comments, Mr. Chairman, I'll have to give you my comment. This is the section that's going to force me to write no recommendation.
Okay, I won't ask you for your reason on that, but
okay,
you'll be fine. Okay, going back then to page 2, Senator Eliason had a question there on the 5% support. If you would relinquish your seat there.
Sir.
Sure. Nagy? Hey. Al. Sorry.
Making my benefits. One more time.
Yes, my last name is pronounced at Tamani, the G silent. To explain to you what the 5% is a normally in a structured settlement, a 5% is stated as a 5% compounded annually for two reasons, either for a period of time or for a lifetime. And the reasons for that is not interest. But the reasons for that in there is that to take care of the cost of living that incurs as time goes by. Say in other words, if it's $1,000 a month, next year it'll be $1,050, and the next year it'll be compounded to 5% on $1,050, and so on and on. And I've given you a outline of that, how a structured settlement operates in the information I gave you. So the people from the insurance industry that testified prior to this, that is not a payment of interest. In the structured settlement industry, it is not a payment of interest. It is a increasing payment that goes for the victim for lost wages, because if it's identified as interest, then it is a taxable income to the individual under Section 104A2 of the code.
if it is defined as a cost of living escalator for lost wages under the Periodic Payment Act, then it is a non-taxable income. So that's why you do not use the terminology interest, and it is normally anywhere from 1% to a maximum of 6% compounded annually. We do that in some occasions, and many occasions we do not do that. And I think to have that in the bill is putting extreme confinements on the injured party. I think that normally what happens is that there will be a present value amount of money that can be paid to the individual in a lump, or if they want to take structured settlements. And let me explain what those are. A structured settlement can be any type of financial package constructed to fit the needs of the individual party that's injured. And what you do is you find out, how many children does he have? What are their educational needs? What are going to be the needs of his spouse? What are going to be the needs of his income? What are going to be the medical needs? All of these things are taken into consideration for the injured party. And then you come and put a financial package together that's going to provide a monthly income. Many times that will have a cost of living escalator in there. Sometimes it won't. Sometimes it'll go along and pay X amount of dollars for 5 years and then up by about 30%. That's called a, you know, step annuity. We will take some sums of money today and invest those for the educational needs of the children when they become eligible for college. There'll be $15,000 a year for 5 years. So all of these things are part of a structured settlement. To mandate where a 5% interest aspect is in there, or mandate a 5% cost of living escalator, is going to really hamper the injured victim out there. Because these things are negotiated between the defense and the plaintiff, and in most instances are approved by a judge. So we want to have that flexibility for that party to decide what they want to do with the money. And I think to have any type of a stipulation as to there's a mandatory 2%, 3%, or 5% is really putting a burden on a person that they may not really want to have that burden placed upon them. And it will not, in many instances, be able to provide the best financial package for that individual. And based on that and the aspects that of the Internal Revenue Code, if that is said to be interest, then that triggers a taxable situation. And that's the concern. I would say my recommendations would be, and the Citizens Coalition would be, is that we want to basically say that structured settlements will be available at the option of the injured party. And they have the option to take either a structured settlement or a lump of present value cash. Because we have done substantial cases where we have not had a cost of living escalator in there. And the reason is we use those funds to provide larger lumps of money on down the line on a tax-free basis. We have had cases where we have put a cost of living escalator in there. So that thing has got to be flexible where the injured party and the judge can make that decision, which fits the needs of that specific injured party. By having that 5% in there creates a substantial number of problems.
I don't see that at all. I'm sorry, Senator. I don't agree with you at all on that.
Well, that's, you know, so, you know, that's your option,
Senator. Sure. I don't mean that, but I mean, it would seem to me that if you want that to happen, then you can allow. If the widest scope of possible to the injured party, you can give them either a choice of taking a cash settlement payment, the whole lump sum, mm-hmm. you can have periodic with a 5% escalator, or you can just have a periodic with no escalator if they don't feel like they want to get the interest. But the majority of the cases of personal injury suits, I'd say 90% maybe are paid by insurance companies or some other company.
Sure.
And they can take half of the money and invest it in an annuity.
Well, that's exactly what happens, you see, is that most of your structures entitlements are placed in annuities. Yeah. You see a very isolated type of situation to where that a company will fund those things out of their general income. They will purchase an annuity from a life company to put that financial package, you know, together, and they're completely off the hook. And
but,
I think
where is the benefit of the periodic payments? Where does that benefit come in? Who is going to receive the benefit from the periodic payments?
The benefit from the periodic payments will come to the injured party.
I don't agree with that either.
Okay. Well, that's, you know, you may want to review the information. The monies will come to the injured party. The benefits.
I could put the money in.
Yes.
If I was an injured party, I can handle an annuity just as well as an insurance company can do it.
That's because of the tax code.
I can make it a deferred payment schedule just the same way they can. I can go all the way down the line with it. I don't have to pay any income tax or anything else. Why should they handle my money for me?
Okay. Let me clarify how the Internal Revenue Service code operates. Is that if a person takes a lump of money under Section 104A2, that money is all income tax free. Okay.
Right.
Now, if he takes that and invests that, or purchases an annuity with that, mm-hmm. then if it's interest, then that's all going to be taxable income to him.
Sure.
If he purchases an annuity, a portion of that's going to be taxable income based on his life expectancy. If the defense purchases that annuity and puts that financial package together for him, then everything he ever receives is all income tax free. That's the difference.
He isn't getting anything. He's getting the bare bones settlement. The same thing he would get in a lump sum.
No, he isn't.
He's getting paid in a periodic deal, isn't he?
No. And I think you might want to review that information that I left there, because...
You can tell me right here.
Okay. Let's just take the example I gave you there, is that a lawsuit might be settled for $4 million.
Mm-hmm.
Out of that comes attorney costs and, of course, the attorney fees. And the injured party might receive out of that $2.1 million in cash. Okay, the total cost of that might be $4.3 million or $4.5 million, depending on what the defense costs are. So that person has received $2.1 million. Now, an annuity can be purchased for, say, $800,000 or $900,000, or even $600,000, depending on the age. That will provide that individual, depending on his age, up to $3 or $4 million over his lifetime, all tax free. So,
wait a minute. You're saying the insurance company, whoever's going to do it, is going to purchase an annuity, and whatever that annuity generates, the guy gets it, and it's tax free.
Yes, it is.
But why isn't it this tax free if he does it?
Because you cannot have constructive receipt, and that goes on back to the Internal Revenue Service code again. If that annuity or that financial package is owned or purchased by the defense, and that injured party has no constructive receipt or constructive control of the monies other than to receive them, then it's all income tax free. That's why structured settlements are so very, very popular. And it's also very beneficial to society as a whole, because in many cases that have been studied in California, is that people have received a lump of money. 85% of those cases that were studied, in 3.5 years, the lump of money is all gone. And under a structured settlement aspect, that money is there come hell or high water. And I think that's the aspect to have. The key is the tax aspects that are available to the injured party if a structured settlement is had. So I think going back is that by having that 5% in there, it is really, it's really putting constrictions on that injured party.
You are causing a problem under your explanation. I don't know if any of the insurance people or any of the attorneys or anybody else, I don't see any of them shaking their heads, so you must have the facts right.
Like I say, there isn't a lot of experts in the United States. There's only a few of them, and fortunately I've been able to associate myself with a couple.
Well, under your scenario of what you're saying, and I have no doubt what you have your facts correct, then putting the 5% on would be damaging.
It would be.
Sure.
To the injured party.
Yeah, the injured party.
Right. Unless we called it cost of living allowance or something like that.
Cost of living allowance, but you're still having a restriction as far as how he can tailor how he wants his money. Because in many times, you can construct a case to go up to 6%. And if that's an option, why should he be confined to 5? So my recommendations would be to the committee to just eliminate that 5% and have it to where it is subject to the approval of the judge or of the two negotiating parties. But have out the 5% figure or any figure like that.
So your recommendation then on the bill then would be to delete that sentence?
Yes, of the 5% figure.
Sentence reads, a judgment ordering the payment of future damages by periodic payments shall also require that each periodic payment be increased at the annual rate of 5%.
Just scratch out.
From the date that the judgment is entered.
Right, just scratch out the 5% and clean up the rest of the language, let that be fine.
Right.
Okay, well, thank you very much, gentlemen.
Thank you. What are the recommendations of the committee on that section?
Well, let's take out the 5% then, Mr. Chairman. I would move we take out the 5% and go back to the original amendments as well.
Okay. Remove the sentence.
Yeah.
Remove that. You do that? Okay. Any objection on that?
No.
All right. We've asked for some. Are there any other changes or amendments there to the bill? Okay. We've asked for some changes, and I'd be a little bit uncomfortable asking for the committee to pass the bill out of committee without seeing those changes before us, plus the addition of the addition to the definition section. So I would intend to hold the bill until Wednesday.
Okay. And before you do that, I'd like to say you're not for science. I wish that you would consider this effective dates on here. Either pass a bill making it effective, period, and then if you want to change it, you can change it again some other time. But as far as making it on a 3-year period, I don't think you're going to get the results that you want.
Yeah, we've taken that out.
Did you take that out?
Yeah. All we're asking for is that a report be submitted under legislative intent.
That's it. Again, I'm singing from the wrong sheet of music. I'm singing from the right one now. Okay.
All we're asking for is that the governor direct the Division of Insurance to monitor the effect of this act, these 5 or 6 basic changes that we're looking at, and to let us know if it's having an impact on the insurance premiums in the state.
Okay.
Yes.
Move to adjourn.
Okay. No further business, and we'll adjourn.
We have to sign something.
Yeah, we have to sign one bill. We have.